just get behind a microphone and so we can take questions. I've been asked to maybe just get the ball rolling by asking one or two questions, and then I'll throw it open to the audience. So, Gerard, I'm going to ask you a question first to sort of connect back to Joel's talk. I mean, you talked about the quantum world and Joel talked about the conscious world. And when you wrote to me, Gerard, and said what you were going to speak about in here, I'll just sort of read this out. You said, your objective is to find out if a quantum computer can learn tasks more efficiently than a classical learning machine. And that's what was the subject of the talk. Now, in a classical learning machine, you can interrogate the state of that machine at any time and see how it's going in its learning. And that you describe that as being like an introspection. Okay, but we know that in the quantum world, if you interrogate a quantum machine, how is it going, it'll collapse the state of that quantum state. And you're just not allowed to do that with a quantum machine. And you describe that this raises the question, can a quantum artificial intelligence ever be conscious? So maybe I could ask you to elaborate on that a little bit.
Okay, so at this point I'm regretting writing any of that, but anyway, let me make a bit of an effort. I hesitate to talk about consciousness in the presence of an expert, but so the lesson here is, I mean, the key issue here is something sometimes called the collapse of the wave function. It refers to the fact that, or the point that I made, that in the quantum world the only facts are the results of measurements, and then they become classical. So if you are a quantum computer and you start interrogating your states at any instant, you're essentially going to make a measurement of what state the quantum transistors are in, and you'll collapse the wave function and destroy the very essence of the quantum advantage in quantum computation in the first place. So if you built a quantum artificial intelligence agent and kept checking to see if it was learning anything, you'd just turn it into a roulette machine. It would just be a huge random number generator. So in some sense, the ability for our conscious states to interrogate what's going on would be very, very limited in a quantum computer. But I've just learnt that it seems to be pretty limited anyway in the thing that's in our heads. So it may well be that introspection isn't necessary for an effective learning machine.
Thanks, Gerard. The other thing I'd like any members of the speaking panel to comment on is that when we were talking about this over lunch, Gerard, that in understanding the quantum world, we try to understand that through mathematics. And when we write down the mathematics, we have what we think is a reasonable approximation of how the quantum world works. If not, we construct models. But we actually can't picture the quantum world in realistic terms. And so, Paul, maybe I could ask you as an artist who, you talked to us very visually in your talk, what do you make of that?
I mean, the complexity is to do with courage in a strange way. I mean, if you were to say that the quantum world is indefinable, that you can't measure it, that you can't understand it or comprehend it as human because it's beyond comprehension, then there's a potential to say, how could we start to image something that's beyond our understanding? Now, has it been done before? Have artists explored that? And did Turner paint something that was beyond the comprehension, the Industrial Revolution sampling all around you? I mean, is it evidenced in that? And the other question maybe would be, if you did, would anybody recognize it? You see, if I did create an image of quantum phenomena, then would anybody be able to see it? Because if it had never been there before, we have no model of it in our heads and no understanding of it, would we actually see it? Well, Joel can tell me the answer to that, I expect. But it seems to me problematic. But artists have attempted to do it, and maybe after time, they have been seen to have some causal relationship with what was happening in culture at the time. I don't know if that answers your question. So, yes, you can visualize data. Yes, the data sets are there. I'm never sure with the brain things going off, whether it's brake lights happening in a car, has got anything to do with stopping the car. You know, when your brake lights go on, it's telling the people behind you that the car's stopping, but it's actually got nothing to do with the mechanical things of stopping, all the heat and everything else that goes on. So I wonder how much of the rest of the body is involved in this process as an agent. And also data visualization, when Cezanne was painting, he had the most complex set of data that you could possibly imagine, the landscape. If anybody's gone to paint a landscape or draw on a landscape, they realize, what the hell do I do? Do I draw each leaf? Do I try and draw the twigs? I mean, there's too much going on here. There's nature, there's haze, there's evaporation, there's light moving, there's photons going everywhere. And what do I do to try and comprehend this? So they translate this data set into a visualization. It's data visualization. It's the same thing. One is mechanistically taking the data and translating it through algorithms. The other is the human trying to express this data. So what I'm saying is that abstract work has been around for a long time, expressing data visualization. And we have a huge history in the arts of understanding abstraction. And this is something that we need to start to bring together with physics and with science and with data visualization, that there is a huge history that we have of it. That's it.
I'll just have one final question and then I'll throw it open to the audience. But Jared, we also talked just after lunch about one of the things that you and I have both found out, you today and me, when I first came here, was this whole concept that artists use sonification to convey a lot of the work. And for me, that was a new experience. You know, I hadn't really thought about sonification before, but sound itself is sort of an abstract thing, and it's got a wave nature. And we had this discussion about, you know, could you, for example, use sonification to experience things like entanglement. So would you like to comment on that, Jerry?
Sure. So this is an idea which is about, I don't know, 90 minutes old, so perhaps don't take it too seriously. But the idea is this. The human ear is very good in recognizing oral correlations. So if you hear two notes an octave apart, you know it's consonant. It's quite clear. And the notion of entanglement is correlation. That is, you ask a question of two separate systems, they always give the same answer, or they always give opposite answers. They're either perfectly correlated or perfectly anti-correlated. So if you took the data from a bell violation experiment and run it through sonification, if that's the word, could you hear the violation of the bell inequality through an oral correlation? It would be like an oral simulation of the correlations of quantum physics. We already know sound is sound waves, and to a large extent, what we're seeing in bell violations is an interference of a wave, a very strange kind, not a physical wave, but a probability wave. So the question is, could you hear the violation of the bell inequality, which would mean, could you hear entanglement more effectively than I can persuade you by doing calculations on a piece of paper? Just that.
It's a good afternoon thought. Andrea, would you?
That's something that can be answered. I mean, we could just, you know, sonify the bell violation data and then prepare some, you know, separable state.
That's true. Exactly. So the uncertainty principle is related to a Fourier transform. The physics of it is quite different, but the mathematics is indeed the same. So there's a trade-off between spectral width and temporal width anyway. That's right. Good point.
One interesting point is this. Oh, yeah. One interesting thing there might be that, so the brain is very plastic and it's constantly changing. And the way you might experience it first, initially, might be quite different after a few days of listening to it or playing with it or learning. In other words, if you think about when someone goes blind, they start learning Braille, the way their brain processes that changes quite a lot over time. And in fact, after a while, they start the visual cortex is processing that touch information, even though it's not visual information. And the same in lots of sort of visual prosthesis, so you can put a thing on the tongue, which stimulates your tongue, and people start experiencing that after some time, almost like visual input. This idea that the brain's kind of plug and play, that you can just plug different kinds of input, and with training and feedback, you can learn to use that, and you learn to experience that in very different ways. Yeah, so that might be interesting.
Yeah,
Could I ask just questions from the audience? Yes.
There is indeed a notion of steady states or equilibrium states in quantum physics. So one way to think about it is if I cool down some water, it will make a transition into a stable state of ice. It's not permanently stable, it's metastable. If it warms up again, it melts. There's a similar notion in physics where you can have wildly fluctuating systems which can approach steady states. They're not actually completely stationary. There are fluctuations there, but the basic correlations and structures are inherent and permanent. And the same thing happens classically, as I said, with ice. One of the curious features in the quantum world is the system can just spontaneously leave that state through something called quantum tunneling, even though it's energetically not favorable for it to do so. So the additional thing that quantum physics adds is this notion of metastability, that sooner or later it all breaks, unless it's completely isolated from the world around it, which is a pretty hard thing to achieve. So quantum physics is not incompatible with the notion of stable, or at least metastable, steady states or stationary states of very complex interacting systems.
Yes?
I'm just wondering how entropy ties into the
quantum. Perhaps I should say a little bit about what entropy is. In classical physics, entropy is a way of ordering possible state transformations. So there are certain ways in which machines can be changed. I can increase the pressure, I can increase the temperature, but there are certain things I can't do. And this goes by the name of increasing entropy. So if there's some physical process that would decrease entropy, then there has to be very special circumstances to enable that to happen. It really means you haven't taken account of the full system. The same thing applies in quantum physics. In fact, a system being subject to measurements will rapidly rise in entropy if you don't know the measurement results. But if you can keep track of the measurement results, you can keep the entropy constant and it doesn't increase at the expense of filling up your memory with more and more and more measurement results. You eventually pay the entropy price when you run out of memory and have to literally go and pay the price of buying some more memory, or you have to erase the memory and start again. So in quantum physics, the entropy cost is usually associated with something called the cost of information erasure. And it was this idea also, which was one of the key inputs to the concept of a quantum computer, in addition to Feynman's work. This idea of the thermodynamics of information was one of the key inputs to thinking about what would happen in a quantum world. I don't know if that answers your question.
When you were speaking about the quantum brain, I was thinking you're going to have to make that million times bigger than it needs to be in this function. And that concept of memory.
One thing I should add is we know that when you erase entropy, there's a minimum amount of heat you must dissipate. This is called the Landau erasure cost. And so if you're doing processing in an irreversible way where you're always erasing information, and that's mostly what's going on in these machines, you necessarily generate a minimum amount of heat. We're not at that level yet, but we're already at the level where we can't make these machines any faster because they generate too much heat.
Yes.
I have a question that kind of goes between
physics and the neurological exploration of the brain?
Physicist Roger Penrose of the Oxford University stated that, or he hypothesized that the human brain is a form of a quantum computer. And based on what you were saying now, that the entropy has a cost of the loss of memory and that the wave function will collapse once you self-reflect, to me it kind of goes back to that thought experiment where when you're hitting a button, when you want to hit it based on the time, could that be a quantum mechanical thought where you can't self-reflect and it's a process that an outsider can look at from the empirical data coming out, but the actual end user can't self-reflect until that has happened?
It's an interesting idea. I don't have a yes or no answer to that. I mean, there's, if you think about the idea that there's clear patterns of neural activity in our brains or our bodies, you know, that we're not conscious of is nothing particularly special. You know, most of it we're not consciously aware of. We're not conscious of things happening in our gut. We're not conscious of lots of things, our immune system, all kinds of things. So there's nothing particularly special about, like, that particular rise. So I don't want to go out there and say too much about the quantum implications of that. I mean, do you want to say something?
I could say something specific about Penrose's idea of quantum consciousness. It turns out to be very difficult to build a quantum processor. We've been trying for a while, Bob. It's also very expensive, Andrea will know. The best that anybody has been able to do, or at least as far as I know, there may be some secret project somewhere, is probably about 12 quantum bits. It's very, very hard because you need to isolate the system and maintain it in its quantum domain so that it doesn't get measured accidentally by the environment. So the idea that there's some sort of quantum processing going on in the brain is extremely unlikely at the level of actual quantum computing. Maybe quantum mechanics is a source of noise in the brain, but I think Penrose's idea of quantum consciousness or quantum computing has been pretty thoroughly discounted by studies of what actually goes on in neural cells. But that's not to say we couldn't, once we've figured out how to build a quantum computer, build a quantum artificial intelligent agent. That would be something quite different.
I think one of the interesting areas is this notion. Is the notion of time. So, if we've had these things for a short amount of time, and the impact that it's had on us and the way that we think, you know, if you were to argue that everything you've seen since, I mean, in the last few years, with your televisions and stuff and your visual world has been digital, then all you've ever seen is code. And therefore, one would argue that maybe you're part code now because of this. And therefore, this notion that you're a human, not a machine, then becomes a questionable thing. So is the brain absorbing this code in the diagram of the reflective agent? And therefore, the agent has become part machine through the code. So all I'm suggesting is that quantum computing is at its formative stage, but what it seems to be suggesting as possible could happen very quickly. And therefore, there's a desire, I think, to start to try and comprehend it as artists who are trying to communicate in relationship to our understanding of being in the world, what is actually is being explored. So therefore, the interest for me is in this notion of, okay, so it's not there yet, but things are happening all the time, and a huge amount of money has been invested. And when they invest that much money, and when Google want to invest that money, they're going to make something like it happen, and they're going to recreate fiction. And so I think we should start to explore this more thoroughly.
Yeah, I mean, to a certain degree, it's already. So when you there's interesting data now that when you ask people whatever general facts about the world, rather than think about the fact, they think about Google, or they think that, so that it's like an idea of extended mind, that Google, that the web is part of their general knowledge, that it's such an automatic habit to rely on that to get the answer to something, that it's just completely natural and smooth and almost sort of...
Yeah. When technologies first were coming out in the network, like in 83, they were talking about global consciousness. They were thinking about a thinking layer around the world that you could just almost put your hand up and draw down into your conscious understanding. This was the utopian idea of technology that was going to happen for us, that we were going to be able to share consciousness globally. And of course, it became corporatized almost instantly, and they lost that kind of vision very quickly of this new kind of understanding of space, this cyberspace that was going to be there. And I agree, it's totally now maybe absorbed. So if it can happen that quickly, then how can quantum computing start to even in its... I mean, look at how big the old computers were. They fill up whole rooms, and the new one is quite huge, isn't it? The new quantum computer that they have. Haven't they got one in Canada that they...
No.
It's massive. Sort of.
Yeah. Well, they have something, but yeah. It's certainly massive, I agree.
So that's... Oh, can
the chip itself is this big, though.
It's roughly proportional to the hype involved in the...
Let me just quickly say one thing. So this thing called panpsychism, which is just starting to become discussed now in sort of neuroscience circles, this idea that, yes, anything can be conscious, right? So probably the leading theory of consciousness is about information integration and sort of states that if you have enough complex information, well, any kind of information, and it's integrated in the right way, then consciousness will just emerge in the thing that's representing that, the physical thing that's representing that information. And the follow-on from that is that whatever, anything can be conscious. So yet the internet, the information there, if it was integrated in the right way, then it would be somewhat conscious, or anything could be, which is interesting.
But that's, I mean, that's...
That's different what, to what, I know, it's different
no,
to what
but
you...
No, but similar to what Tegmark...
I'll get you to, sorry. Speaking about, sorry.
Yeah. So it's similar to what Tegmark really is seems to be saying, that materiality has the potential to be conscious. In other words, it's the same material that we're using for our consciousness, let's say, just for the sake of argument, then the potential is that the material could then be conscious. So we have this sort of... It's like I've been looking at graphite pencil that becomes graphene. Graphene is used in quantum computing. So is there the potential for these materials, which are 18% of us as humans... is there a causal link or a causal relationship to this? I mean, of course, they don't know the answer to that.
Well, if it was conscious, how do we know, right? So this idea that if our gut is conscious doesn't mean we would have access to it. So you could have micro-conchi or different bubbles of consciousness in things, and we would never know. How would we know?
But
we can't measure it.
Would it shift your perception of the material world? So when... In 2003, when they discovered graphene, and now graphene is one of the big materials that they're exploring in science for its properties. But that was part of the humble pencil that you were drawing with. So now you know that this material is inherently in the pencil. It's 200 times stronger than steel and all the other things that they say about it. Does it change your understanding of the agency of the pencil now that you... So what I'm saying is the material, it changes your conscious understanding of materiality. And so then you reflect on drawings that you've seen now, and you reflect that they are made of graphene, single layers, and they potentially had more information in them now than they did before you understood what graphene was.
It seems to me that, I mean, it's often been said that nothing makes sense in biology except in the light of the theory of evolution. So the key question one has to ask is, what is the function of consciousness? And I have a feeling that somehow or other it's related to the notion of agency, because if I was thinking of designing a robot to go out and function as an artificial intelligent agent, if it was the only thing in the world, it probably doesn't need to be conscious. But if it has to interact with other robots and other agents, it has to be able to distinguish sensory data coming in that it is responsible for to sensory data coming in that is not responsible for. In other words, you have to build in some module to enable the machine not just to know where it is and when it is, but to know that it is at all. And I have a feeling that probably some kind of simple computational module like consciousness would have to go into a sufficiently complex artificial intelligent agent if it was to function appropriately in a world of other artificial intelligent agents.
So why do you think that?
I'm going to ask for a question.
Oh.
Well, that's fascinating. I mean, before I get on to my other discussion, my other question, it was that perhaps the consciousness is fundamental, and occasionally it collapses into matter, into material things if its self-desperation is great enough. If the intellectual investment is sufficient, it can collapse. But getting back to quantum computing, the general understanding, I think, is that, you know, what us lay people think, is that their machine's not terribly well understood yet, perhaps only 12 bits or a small number of bits, that can somehow occupy this superposition and calculate with superpositions. But your other answer was that's not really happened. That's been found to be too hard, is it? Or
oh no, it's because certainly hard, but the progress is steady.
They can open minds.
Yep.
And that's what that's why we think we can do it, because we can sort of have a superposition of opinions about a certain topic without necessarily collapsing to a position on it.
That's right. That's because the information in our brains is represented in classical states, not quantum states. So we can measure them without changing them in any way. Well, we are literally just reading out what is already there. In quantum physics, this is the key difference between classical and quantum physics. In classical physics, we maintain the illusion that measurement results reveal facts of the matter that were there regardless of whether I measured it or not. In the quantum world, we cannot take that second step, and that's what violation of Bell inequalities tells us. There are correlations between measurement results which are not revealing pre-existing objective facts out there in the world that we're just coming to know about. I know it's hard to swallow, but that's the only way we can actually understand the difference between quantum and classical physics.
Actually, I wanted to make a comment on something that you, Bob, said earlier, that we cannot visualize quantum phenomena, right, or quantum systems. I think this is a statement that needs to be somewhat qualified, because I do think that over the last, 15, 20 years, there has been a progress in essentially scientific instrumentation that has changed the way that my generation and the generation of my students sees quantum mechanics. Think of the STM, the scanning tunneling microscope, right? We can see atoms now, or the transmission electron microscope. Before that, atoms were things you could write, the quantum mechanical equations for, the orbitals of the atom. You could get someone to draw, the sp and the orbitals. Now we can actually see them with an instrument that uses, of course, quantum effects. We can actually make a visualization of that. So I would like to, point out that the progress in, I can call it engineering and instrumentation, is providing us and our sensorial means with a new bridge to the quantum world. And so the way we look at things is improving and is updating with the technology that goes with that. And then you could think of taking it to the next level. There is this, it's kind of fading out a bit, but there is this big hype of things like, magnetoreception in birds that might come from quantum phenomena, right? So there is this hypothesis that there are these birds, these migratory birds that migrate from north to south in Europe, they fly over Germany, and they are hit by a photon in the eye, and there is a pair of electrons in an entangled state, like most electrons are in every chemical bond, in every molecule of your body, there is an entangled pair of electrons. And they split apart, and then whether or not they recombine and give a stimulus to the eye depends on whether or not they are still in an entangled quantum state or not, which might depend on how they fly with respect to the magnetic field. Now, imagine, and we're already seeing some of that. There was this paper I saw the other day, this Cyberwood, where they integrated tobacco cells with carbon nanotubes to make this super sensitive temperature sensor, 1,000 times more sensitive than anything known so far. So if we could functionalize our senses, so let's say we could introduce other material, be it nanotubes, be it, nitrogen vacancy centers in diamond that have quantum coherent states at room temperature. So if we could enhance our senses and our receptor with things that are engineered and fabricated and designed to display well-understood quantum phenomena, maybe we could take it even to the next level. Now we're just making instruments to give us a picture of the atomically precise, the surface of a material, but maybe we can take it even further. I imagine that this would be a big theme of the next century, integrating, artificial, potentially quantum materials with our, natural body.
Mm. I'll just make a comment on that connects with something you said about Faraday. Until Faraday came along, the only sorts of things there were in the world were sort of, billiard balls that bounced off each other. It was entirely mechanical. the notion of a field, an electric field and a magnetic field, entered physics with Faraday. And how did he get the idea across? He used iron filings who formed into the shape of the field. You couldn't see the field, but you could certainly see the pattern of the iron filings. So using physics to invent new modes of perception or new sensory inputs is the key.
Now we can all visualize a magnetic field perfectly naturally.
That's right. Yeah. So this was what you were suggesting was in Turner's painting.
Yeah, but the other thing that comes from that is if in the turn of the century when Mare did his chronophotographs to visualize motion and movement so that we could actually see movement, because movement happens too quickly for us, we can't see it, therefore we don't understand how something got from there to there because it happened too quickly for our eyes. So the photograph that Mare took against black backgrounds to show movement affected the whole of the art world. I mean, you wouldn't have had futurism without Mare's photographs. You wouldn't have this visualization of something that we couldn't see. But the reaction was also against it, because in some ways there was a mechanical version of how we see. So the question then is, a mechanical, instrumental version of the way we see relevant to consciousness? Or is consciousness not mechanical in the same way? So that became, if you understand what I'm suggesting, is that it's like a sequence of events that are measured of one after the other, where consciousness is a stream and therefore doesn't have these sequence of events. So the chronophotographs are taken in a mechanical way as a series of sequences. So if we see in a series of sequences, then as consciousness we don't understand the world like that. We're bringing in a lot more information and processing it at the same time. So all I'm suggesting is that when we instrumentalize the world, we have to be careful of how we critique, like Karen Barad said about turning up the light to see how dark it is. Our instruments play a huge part in how we read the equipment. And even at an atomic level, if everything is atomic and everything is quantum and you're using quantum things to measure quantumness, it seems that there could be a strange qualities that are being developed. And you can see that in the measurement of the double slit experiment, which a lot of this, is it a double slit? Made on.
Yep. I'm really interested in the way the brain is this preemptive, proactive, predictive organ. And just kind of picking up on two points, one that Andrea just made about this kind of biological aspect of quantum phenomena occurring in bird brain navigation. And it also relates to what Jared was saying about Roger Penrose, because I think they have kind of discovered that there are quantum microtubule processes happening in the human brain. But I don't know if that, you know, I don't think that that's going to be kind of like the magic bullet that explains consciousness. I think, but what I'm interested in is how it's this proactive, predictive process of the brain is also a social, symbolic kind of language-based process. But, they're the things that I'm interested in. I'm wondering if anyone's got anything to add.
Can you elaborate a little bit more on the predictive? You mean just like, In the sense of the thing I talked about, or just in general? The brain's very, like, it's making predictions all the time.
Yes.
And you can think about the way you see this room now is not like, it's not like a photograph of a digital camera. It's a better way to think about it is an interaction between hallucinations, your imagination, and the world. And that interaction is going on all the time. So your brain's filling in different spots. It's filling in color around the outside. You have a blind spot that's being filled in. All kinds of things are going on. So the brain's making predictions about, in a Bayesian sense, if you know what I mean by that, based on past probabilities and what might happen next, and that's all going on all the time. Is that kind of?
I think neuroscientists are quite interested in the way that the human brain works to finish other people's sentences, for example, because that's what we can do. We can kind of predict other people's behaviour. We develop theories of mind, about age 4 or 5. And so there is this kind of predictive aspect of the human brain, which I like to look at in terms of telepathy. But neuroscientists will avoid that term and use all the other terms like empathy and social brain, extended cognition, but it's, yeah, that's what I'm interested in.
Hmm.
Well, thank you for these really nice and stimulating talks. I just have a comment on something that Andrea has suggested. I agree that sort of technological enhancement in the way of sort of like, you know, visualizing atoms and their trajectories and magnetic forces and fields will certainly sort of like bring that information that is invisible to our normal biological sort of like sensory systems into kind of realm of visible. But I'm just a little bit skeptical, and I wonder what are your views on this, that just by simply bringing this in front of our eyes, all of a sudden it is going to be possible for us to see what is there. And I'm reminded by sort of like, you know, I mean, my motivation for stating this is something that Gerard mentioned. Like, you would try to build consciousness into artificial agent once it has to interact with other agents. So we sort of like, you know, we are aware of the visual information that supports effectively our interaction with the visual world. So, and in sensory domain as well. So without that interaction, kind of, you know, things exist, but we are not really, you know, we can't access it. And as far as interaction is concerned, scale is extremely important. So in realm of visual processing information, scale of our hands and our faces, where the sort of like most kind of like very, very important visual information comes from, is the most sort of like, you know, important one. And I'm just wondering, we might bring all of these magnetic fields and all of these other things there, but they're going to be perhaps shown in a way that we can't, they're not going to be, I think, scale suited for sort of like ability of our visual system to comprehend meaning in them, perhaps.
Yeah, well, I certainly sympathetic to, so it is true that the quantum world can't be captured in our ordinary everyday language because we don't experience the world that way. And we don't yet have the tools, until very recently, to see individual quantum events. In fact, that's been a big discovery in the last 10 years, and Nobel Prize was awarded for that a couple of years ago. Nonetheless, we discovered the world was quantum 100 years ago, and we have a theory of enormous predictive value. It is written in the language of mathematics, so even though we don't have the ordinary language categories to talk about, explain, give intuition to what's going on in the quantum world, we have mathematics to understand it. So why is that? Eugene Wigner, a very famous physicist, wrote a famous essay talking about the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics. One answer to that might be because the world, the quantum world, as well as the classical, is in fact a learnable problem, and mathematics captures the algorithm that we've learnt to explain the world, even if we cannot express it in common language terms or visualize it easily.
And doesn't mean that we may learn to be able to experience it, maybe not visually, but maybe in you know, multidimensional, multi-senses in some way. It's a matter of getting the data into the brain in some way and then learning to process it.
Yeah. Visual scale is important. You could think of a scanning tunneling microscope as an instrument that transforms a scale of a nanometer into a scale of a pixel on a computer screen. That's kind of what it does. So it brings us exactly to that scale that is most relevant.
There's this kind of like fractal structure of the external world when you have information that is space aligned at different spatial scales and different temporal scales that define sort of like events in the world that we are experiencing within the world that we have kind of evolved to live in. Is that captured somehow by these quantum kind of descriptions of it? That is sort of like, you know, my question. I mean, like you mentioned Fourier transform, sort of like, you know, information. It's what seems to happen in the quantum kind of domain is that the phase relationship kind of falls.
You eventually see those. I mean, there's you know, work by our colleague, you know, Sven Roger. He saw the wave function of an electron in silicon, which has the particular property of having oscillations because of some phase interference between essentially the minimum energy of an electron in the periodic potential of the lattice of silicon causing interference. You can see that in a picture like this. It's exactly what this instrument does for you.
No, I agree that it's a very promising
Yeah, I feel beautifully out of my depth in this situation. But so I'll make just a couple of thoughts. To start with, as an artist, I'm kind of wary of art playing a role of just being the visualizer of these things. I think that's a kind of a meaningless thing for it to do.
Is this on?
It's on, but you have to switch. Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm wary of the artist's role being to visualize these things. I mean, most good artists will say, no, fuck off, I don't want to visualize it. Well, I'm involved. But just a couple of observations, because I am interested in consciousness, but I now realize that I'm out of my depth. But we know that there's this problem of magnitude of, you know, if the brain could, you know, operate with quantum knowledge or express that, it just wouldn't work. It perhaps would fail in the way in which you're talking about. But it's very interesting with artists, if they do start to visualize. Paul brought up Turner, you know, it's usually after some excessive breakage. Like Monet starts to really see something else when he's going blind. He refuses to believe that, but they put glasses on him and he says, it's not my work. We have various other artists, the Japanese artist who does all those dot things. She's quite psychotic and has to be put in a home at night. So we know as artists that, and most of us are manic depressives, and so through these breakages, the ability to see this other world perhaps can be made. It's almost like a crude analogy with a computer, that you clear space in order that something can come in. I think it's I've forgotten the word. But yeah, our little man in his wheelchair. What's his name? Yeah, coincidence is the word. I'm also 61. I'm going more breakage. But it's no coincidence that he's the one who can start to think more deeply. He's broken all these other limitations, you know, and then. Paradoxically, a lot of artists want to limit things so they can see things. If you take a Matthew Barney drawing restraint, Duchamp, starts to become impotent and then plays chess rather than make things. I mean, there's kind of this need for things to be wrong or to be broken in order to make space for us to see something. I don't know whether that makes sense, but. I think that this sort of complexity, in fact, my own reading about consciousness, you know, we have to get rid of Descartes' dualism and go to monism, which is fairly primitive if we're going to think about material having consciousness. And in the same way, and I'm battling with this, I just want to make this one more. Paul's going, shut up. I just wanted to put this into the debate. Yes, within that reading, as I read further in this problem and with this interest that artists have with chance mistakes, I came across a number of people who were talking about, you know, memetics really being what's needed in computing. The ability, consciousness really to be proven, the computer has to make mistakes. And the memetic computer, quite apart from the quantum computer, we need to have so that it actually builds up through this iterations and iterations and mistakes and mistakes. This are more. It's as if that's the only way it can really see, and that's parallel to this, you know, starting to get cataracts in your eyes before you can really start to. So what does that mean?
That was fantastic. I'm going to ask the panel to comment. Jared, can I ask you first? Maybe speak into the microphone, Jared.
I don't know. I can't really think of anything to say except to. But I, one thing I would like to emphasize, a learning machine is not a computer. I mean, it has computational elements, but it goes well beyond that because it's embodied. It acts in the world and takes data from the world. It's contingent. what it's going to do in the future depends on its past history, which will be different for every learning agent. So there's already a fair degree of luck or chance involved in any learning machine. Some will learn effectively, some won't. So it's not like a computer where you put data in at one end and wait, and out every time the right answer comes out the other end and never makes a mistake. A learning machine must make mistakes to be a learning machine. In terms of forgetting things, I really took comfort from Hans Bruegel's discovery that the machine didn't work very well as a learning machine unless it forgot things on a regular basis. I find that very encouraging, particularly as I get older.
Joel?
I don't have that much to add, but this idea that exploring and getting feedback seems to be an interesting way to set things off on their own course. And if you're talking about artificial intelligence or something like that, that you don't have to plan out at the beginning where the thing will end up. So this idea of evolution, that it'll go off in its own direction and you'll have many, many failures, but if you start off with enough things at the beginning, then some of them will end up somewhere really interesting. So, yeah, I don't have that much. It's a nice idea, I think.
I mean, we're 100 years from Malevich's black square, you know, which is a... You'd have to work out whether that was an intuitive flash or whether there was something happening or whether it's just built up over a period of time. And now we're dealing with the blackest black, with certain experiments with nanotubes that absorb nearly all light, and artists are working with these areas. So we've got this sort of continuity of exploring the unknowable, and suddenly these things happen, as Richard was saying, this whatever it is that makes it happen happens. It's the synergies, it's forces, but it's not discarded. I mean, you do something that's never been seen before and you don't rub it out necessarily because it's a mistake and say that's rubbish. You say I'm trusting in this, I'm believing in this, and I'm empowering in this work to carry on. And I think there's something in that, you know, when you empower the thing that you make to be the thing, even if nobody else understands it. I mean, nobody understood Einstein when he did his... Did they? Did anybody understand Einstein's theory of relativity when he did it, or was it about one person?
Well, there's a famous joke that a journalist, Arthur Eddington, was also a very famous physicist who did a lot of work on general relativity. A journalist once asked him in New York, "Professor Eddington, is it true that there are only three people in the world who understand Einstein's theory of relativity?" And he paused. And the journalist said, "Well," and he said, "I'm trying to think of who the third one is."
Jared, I want to throw something in just from left field, because we've talked very, very, very briefly about this, and indeed it's a very, very, very small quantity, but is a quantum description of a world complete? And so we talk about, we're all familiar with quantum energy levels, and we describe that, but in the mathematics, time is a continuous variable. And there's been some discussion over many decades of, is time itself quantized? Now, if it is quantized, it's very small. And there have been people have postulated what type of experiment would you need to do to observe that very, very small quantity, and they tend to be on an astrophysical scale. Do you want to... And they're called chronons, so the quantization of time is a chronon with a CH. So do you want to comment on that, Juris? Missing from the mathematics.
Sure. Yeah, no, it's something I'm working on right now. So it's an important point to emphasize that we know for sure that quantum mechanics is not the full story. Why do we know that? Because we have two utterly incompatible, incredibly successful theories of the world. One is general relativity, which explains the cosmos incredibly well. Our GPS system wouldn't work properly if we didn't understand the principles of general relativity. Then we have quantum physics, which predicts extremely well what's going on in the lab and in atomic scales. But these theories are utterly incompatible. They are fundamentally incompatible, and one of the key problems is the nature of time. And it may yet turn out that in whatever theory eventually replaces quantum physics and general relativity will answer the question, what is time and what is space? And there's a hint of it already in the violation of the Bell inequalities, because we're only puzzled about the violation in those particular cases where the measurement devices are sufficiently far apart that we're convinced ourselves there's no communication going on between them. But the Belloni qualities will be violated no matter where the detectors are. They could be sitting right on top of each other. It's exactly the same. There is no space-time story for the violation of the Belloni quality. We're surprised by it because it's incompatible with our intuition of relativity. So the very essence of what we mean by space and what we mean by time is yet unresolved and will have to be resolved to make make quantum physics and general relativity compatible.
Can I ask, this is the question that's been, I want to ask Gerard. So you mentioned randomness as a sort of input and sort of played a role. It strikes me that the idea of something being random is a hypothesis and not a known. How would you know, it's a null result. How would you ever know if something really is random or this idea of randomness actually exists? And do we know? So if randomness didn't exist, what would happen to these theories? Or, you know, if you can't have something that's random, if there's always some level of information pattern in that.
Yep.
So how do you think about that and how does that
fit? Well, that goes to the core of what quantum physics is about. So we may turn out to be wrong, but at the moment our understanding of the quantum world is it's an irreducible source of randomness. Now, many people thought that, sure, the quantum world is random, but that's because we haven't tried hard enough to figure out what the real variables are that are causing the outcomes. And that's the essence of the Bell inequality. Bell was able to quantify what would be the consequences for the experiment if there were hidden variables that we were never going to learn about. But they were nonetheless classical. They were these things that really were out there. And if we could get access to them, we'd be able to figure out exactly what was going on. Bell said, well, let's make them classical, but let's hide them forever so that no one can see them. And that leads to different predictions to quantum physics. So we have to abandon that idea at the moment. So as far as we know, quantum mechanics is an inexhaustible source of randomness. In fact, there's a whole technology built on this. There are technologies to build extremely fast random number generators to encrypt real-time video data, which are based on quantum randomness. Every other random number generator is only pseudo-random, and you can actually find patterns in it if you're careful enough. But those based on quantum randomness are truly random. Very simple example, radioactive decay. If you want an example of the quantum world in action, nuclei would not decay if it was not a quantum world. That's quantum tunneling. And whether a given nuclei decays now or on Sunday or 10,000 years from now, completely random event.
So it's the lack of, the absence of evidence is not, you know,
no,
it's,
no,
it's
I
a,
agree.
A null it's, result, it's, basically.
It's
so how would you ever?
It's an interpretation of the experiments in the light of the quantum theory. So is there a definitive proof? Well, there'll never be because this is an empirical science.
But randomness is still just a hypothesis. Is it right to say that? Would you feel comfortable saying that, or is it?
The way the quantum theory is written tells us that if the quantum theory is the correct description of these experiments, then the randomness is irreducible.
Oh, okay. So it's an
you can prove it in the mathematics, but of course the world may be different in the end.
Mm.
I think this is a subject that we could probably talk about, and people have been talking about for a very long time, but I'd like to maybe draw this to a close now. We're close to 6 o'clock. The richness of this conversation, particularly the different perceptions of the artists and the artistic world and the scientists and the scientific world, all equally valid, is that richness is the reason that I'm here at the Faculty of Art and Design. And while I'm here, I'm going to try and tease out a little bit more of these conversations. We're never going to solve the problem, but we can open up the discourse, and I think we'll all be the better for it, because it's very interesting to think about these things, even if we, it does your head in, which it does my head in quite a lot of the time. But I'd like to thank our speakers, Paul Thomas, Gerard Milburn, and Joel Pearson. I'd like you to thank them in the normal way. And thank you very much for coming on a Friday afternoon at this hour. Thank you.
Yeah.
I've seen those earlier experiments by the